Why would an incumbent member of Congress decide to leave Washington to run for office as a county public works commissioner? I'm Zoe Clark, in today for Lester Graham on Stateside. We'll get the answer from the source when we talk with former Michigan Secretary of State and current Republican Congresswoman Candace Miller. That's coming up later in the hour. But first, it is Friday, so let's take a few minutes to review the week's political news before we jump into the weekend. Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics, joins us now. Hey, Rick.
Hi, Zoe.
So let's start with what you and I began the week looking at on It's Just Politics, and that is this large pool of money that the State House and State Senate are currently at odds over for the Detroit public schools. The Republican-led Senate has a plan. It has backing from both Republicans and Democrats, as well as Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan and Republican Governor Rick Snyder. But the State House has a different plan. Now, we thought we might see some movement this week to get the House and Senate closer together, but that did not happen.
No, it did not. And as a matter of fact, we saw really more of a fracturing when last week the State House Republicans met in a marathon session. And
15 hours.
Yep. And jammed through on party line votes, bills that just went in a completely different direction than the Senate compromise package. I mean, everything just kind of ground to a halt. And so what we saw this week was we thought maybe that the House and Senate would do something to try and put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But what we seem to be getting is more of a cooling off period where everyone can just kind of step back, chill a little bit, and think about things before they come back possibly next week to try and get that whole effort restarted.
And there is a timing issue here because
Absolutely.
The schools are set to run out of money to actually, you know, pay the bills by this summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there just are no good options here. As a matter of fact, the emergency manager in charge of Detroit schools right now was the bankruptcy judge who oversaw the Detroit bankruptcy. And he says that this is just a completely different deal, that there's just not enough unsecured debt to even make bankruptcy worthwhile. So we have just this uncharted territory of what would happen if the Detroit public schools actually just defaulted.
Mm-hmm. Meantime, Rick, you were at the State Board of Canvassers this week. A meeting was held, and we have an issue with signatures. That is, whether or not petition signatures that are more than 180 days old should be counted. At stake could be marijuana legalization in Michigan. Explain what's going on here.
Well, and not just marijuana legalization, that there is a petition drive underway to legalize marijuana, but there's also the one to ban fracking. Mm-hmm. There's one to require paid medical leave. And we know that these ballot drives have been struggling to get enough signatures to get their question either before the legislature or on the ballot. And the culprit in their eyes is this 180-day rule that state elections officials have been using for many, many, many years. And the principle is called rebuttable presumption. And what it says is that if a signature is more than 180 days old, we assume that that person is no longer a registered voter. But if you can prove that they still are a registered voter, then we'll count it. We'll put it back in the pot. And the problem is that right now, that requires going and checking the local voter records of local clerks or getting an affidavit from the person who signed it, which is just so arduous that it's, as a practical matter, impossible. The head of the marijuana legalization drive said that the state is basically asking these petition campaigns to go chase a unicorn. And what's frustrating for them is there is some place they could check, that the state actually has an electronic database of all the registered voters. It's called the qualified voter file. They say, well, if you'll let us use that, then, you know, maybe we can do this and then we won't be as hurt by this 180-day rule. The bipartisan Board of State canvassers, two Republicans, two Democrats, and everything requires a bipartisan vote, deadlocked on the question. The Republicans said no. And so now the marijuana legalization drive is saying, if you're not going to accept our signatures that we should be counting since the last gubernatorial election, and that's in the state constitution, then maybe we'll just have to take you to court.
Okay, keeping a lookout for that. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief, the Michigan Public Radio Network, and my co-host of It's Just Politics, Rick. Happy Friday. Thanks so much.
Happy Friday. Proud co-host.
Cuba's healthcare system is one of its greatest achievements. Healthcare is considered a human right in the country, and it's free. Cuba spends far less than the U.S. on healthcare, yet Cubans have the same life expectancy as Americans. But after students from Michigan State University's medical school were embedded in Cuban clinics and hospitals, they discovered the situation there is complicated. As part of our Pure Cuba series, Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports on some of the good, the bad, and the ugly in Cuban healthcare.
Dr. Luis Alberto Solar Salaveri works at the Pediatric Hospital of Central Havana. Like all Cuban doctors, Solar is a government employee. Honestly, he could make more money driving a taxi, but he has too much passion for the work to quit.
Every time when I wake up in the morning and go to the hospital, I don't think about money, because if I think about money, I stay home.
Doctors like Solar are justifiably proud of the health system here. Cuba had to develop its own vaccines because of the U.S. embargo. Today, close to 100% of Cuban children are vaccinated against a wide array of diseases. Cuban researchers developed a treatment for diabetic foot ulcers the U.S. doesn't have, and a lung cancer vaccine. And there's a family doctor in every neighborhood.
Once you build the health system based on primary care, you'll have a good system. And that's what happened in Cuba.
Gail Reed says the focus on prevention and early treatment makes a big difference. She's the founder of MEDIC, a group that encourages ties between U.S. and Cuban medical professionals. Reed acknowledges there are cracks in the system, many caused by the former Soviet Union withdrawing its financial support in 1989.
I mean, the Cubans went through a devastating economic collapse in the 1990s, and it really played havoc with all of the institutions, and you can see that today still in many of the hospitals and other infrastructure, and also in the availability of some medications.
Despite this, Reed says Cuba has some real public health bragging points. Special wards for women with high-risk pregnancies reversed an uptick in low birth weight babies. So far, authorities have kept Zika from gaining a foothold. Reed says this explains why, despite the shortcomings, people have confidence in the healthcare system.
Because they know that when there's a major danger, they're going to do something about it.
Cuban authorities take pains to show the country's healthcare in the best possible light, but they couldn't hide some of the more disturbing aspects of the system when they agreed to embed medical students from Michigan State University in Cuban clinics and hospitals. After the first week, as Kendra Camp puts it,
the glow started fading.
Standard equipment was often missing. One student had to insert a catheter with used gloves and no alcohol swab. Another observed a patient undergoing a painful procedure to scrub dead tissue off his arm with no pain relief save a cloth in his mouth. The worst incident was a botched abortion of an 8-week-old fetus. Camp says the doctors used a speculum that was too small, resulting in extensive tissue damage to the patient.
In comparison to the U.S., we focus really on the patient and what is best for the patient. And it seemed, from our point of view, that the focus was on making do with little resources.
Students also felt some cost-saving measures are counterproductive, like not doing routine blood tests on newborns. Based on what med student Bo Pang saw,
I much prefer going back to America for my care.
To be fair, these med students still think the U.S. could learn from Cuba, especially from its focus on primary care, prevention, and public health. For his part, pediatrician Luis Salar says Cubans are eager to learn from Americans and to share Cuban expertise with them, not just in healthcare, in every way.
Take our good things. This country is your country, in the better sense of the word, yes.
Michigan State University plans to remain involved in the dialogue. The university will make the deep dive into Cuban healthcare a permanent course elective for medical students, with a new group visiting the country next spring. I'm Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News.
And you can check out the sights and scenes from Michigan Radio's trip to Cuba and follow all of our stories at michiganradio.org. Tomorrow in Grand Rapids, more than 18,000 people are expected to take part in the 5th Third Riverbank Run. The annual multi-event competition features a 25K road race, plus a 5K community walk, and everything in between. So the event is not only good for your health, but it also raises awareness for participating charities and groups. One group is the Open Door Women's Center. Bob Kreider is the marketing director of Dégagé Ministries. It's the group that runs the women's homeless shelter. He says a dozen women will be taking part in the 5K walk tomorrow.
The women come together who stay at the Open Door and women who had stayed there previously but now have their apartment or in transitional housing. And they practice for a few months where they're walking all every week. They keep each other accountable. And it's also setting a goal.
Kreider says because the women have been through so many challenges, the walk is a goal many of them can focus on.
And for some of them, when they reach this goal of walking across that finish line, it's a huge achievement.
One of the women taking part in the 5K walk is Tammy. She once lived at Open Door Women's Shelter. Now she's living on her own. She says the run has helped her accomplish something she couldn't have done on her own.
Just the teamwork, you know, that we're all together doing it and, okay, if I can do this, I can work at achieving something else in the future.
Tammy now helps men and women who are struggling with homelessness or substance abuse. The 5th Third Riverbank Run takes place tomorrow in Grand Rapids. Up next, the Traverse City Hockey Club strikes back at parent-driven sports culture. And then a look at the life and work of architect Minoru Yamasaki. That's coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Lester Graham. There's a lot of complaining these days that kids' sports are too expensive and too competitive. And in fact, kids are dropping out. Most sports are on the decline in the U.S. But a sport that is not losing players is hockey. It's one that's changed the way it trains young athletes. The approach has been so successful that the U.S. Olympic Committee recently adopted it. And the hockey club in Traverse City was a pioneer in the effort. Interlochen Public Radio's Peter Payette has more.
Kurt Fraze can remember exactly where he was when he realized something was wrong with youth hockey. He was at Center Ice in Traverse City coaching his son's team, kids ages 5 and 6.
And I was having them stop on a line, and no one could stop. Like, they could not stop.
Fraze says even the best player on the team couldn't stop, and they were getting ready for a game on a full-size rink, 200 feet of ice.
And the kids couldn't handle a puck, and they had no control on their skates. And I just thought, why are we doing this?
15 years later, Kurt Fraze says he understands why they were doing it. He says people want instant gratification. And for youth hockey, that meant parents expected to see their kids playing a game that looked like the one on TV.
And so what it is at that age, you got the two best kids from each team going up and down the ice, trading scoring chances, and the other eight kids on the ice are kind of just watching them, trying to be involved.
Come on, guys, find the net this time. Come on, go!
But because of people like Kurt Fraze, that's not what happens in many places where kids play hockey today. They play games on half the rink. George Atkinson is running a tournament at Center Ice in Traverse City. He's the president of the Michigan Amateur Hockey Association. He says kids learn to play hockey better in a smaller rink. Even those fast players, the ones that used to be able to break away and take all the shots.
Now it's much more congested. They have to learn how to control the puck, skate with the puck, work through traffic. All the things that if they're ever going to aspire to a high level of hockey, they're going to have to learn to be successful.
Hard. Changes like this are not rocket science. In fact, they weren't even new ideas 15 years ago when Kurt Fraze started questioning how youth hockey was run. For instance, Fraze says back then, USA Hockey recommended that kids practice 3 times as much as they play in games. But he says almost nobody followed that advice.
At the time, the travel teams were playing more games than they were practicing, so it was flip-flopped.
Kurt Fraze began making changes in Traverse City with the teams he coached. For instance, his travel team practiced four times as much as they played in games and tournaments. But Frays wasn't the only one thinking about all this a decade ago. Officials at USA Hockey were asking similar questions. Ken Martell has led a lot of the work there. Martell says at USA Hockey they were worried about a problem almost all sports have. Many players quit by age 12.
A lot will tell you they're not having fun. They're being overcoached. They are, you know, parents and, you know, too pushy, burned out on youth sport.
So in 2009, USA Hockey made a few changes, like putting games for 8 and under players on half ice. Ken Martell says people did not like it, and it's taken years to convince them that this is a better way.
You know what it is? It's just change. People don't like change. You know, someone that grew up playing a certain way, it's like, well, this is what I did when I grew up. It's good enough for me.
You know, when I played hockey, you know, we played on a full ice, obviously. It was much more game-oriented. It was much more about whether you win or lost. And I don't remember.
That's Andrew Hiss taking a phone call from his wife. He's at center ice watching the tournament. Hiss grew up in Maine and played hockey. Now his daughters play in Traverse City. He says club hockey here is not just different for the kids. Part of the change is about rewiring the expectations of parents.
You know, I was just having a conversation with one of the coaches about, well, what do I, how do I talk to my kid after a game or after a practice? And do I get on her about hustling more? Do I get on her about being aggressive more? And the coach said was no. Just say, ask her if she had fun.
Grand Traverse Hockey Association is one of 20 teams in the country to be named a model club by USA Hockey. And the change in the sport nationwide has been so profound that the U.S. Olympic Committee recently endorsed this approach and is using it to inspire change in other sports. Chris Snyder is the director of coaching for the Olympic Committee. Snyder says they want to keep kids playing.
The less athletes playing sports in the United States, the less athletes that have a chance to become Olympic caliber, which means we'll have less athletes on the podium. So that really stymies the Olympic Committee and something that where we see that we really need to find ways to help out.
Snyder says the USA hockey model sets a high standard for athletics.
And it's something that we feel every sport can really rally behind because it takes the research about how to keep kids in sports, how to make it developmentally appropriate, but also puts expectations on key outcomes.
Kurt Frays says changing the culture of a sport is hard work. He faced a lot of opposition over the years and gets a little emotional when he remembers those days. Frays was a semi-professional hockey player in Manitoba. But he says this wasn't about hockey. It was about helping kids.
And you never get an opportunity to be a child again. It wasn't about hockey itself. It was about how kids learn. And that's what drove me.
The U.S. Olympic Committee says more than 20 sports organizations have pledged to make similar changes in their sports. For Stateside, I'm Peter Payette in Interlochen, Michigan.
Michigan has, at the very least, its fair share of pretty magnificent architects. There's a new book out about one of them, the title, Yamasaki in Detroit, A Search for Serenity. The author is John Gallagher. He spoke recently with Stateside's Lester Graham.
Before we start talking about what Minoru Yamasaki designed, tell us about his early life.
Well, he was born in Seattle in 1912. His parents were immigrants from Japan who had met and married in Seattle, and he was their oldest son. The family was quite poor initially. Their father had multiple jobs going at all the time. And like a lot of immigrant families, they put tremendous hopes on their oldest son to be the one who succeeded in America. And a lot of the drive and perfectionism that Minoru Yamasaki showed later in life as an architect, I think, began with this pressure from his family and that he put on himself to succeed. He was a brilliant student. He attended the University of Washington for his degree in architecture. He had to work summers at a fish cannery in Alaska to make some money. This is during the Great Depression, where he experienced a lot of very long, dirty, very difficult hours in this fish cannery, and came out of that experience thinking that he needed to find some basic human dignity in his life and in his workplace, and went to New York City to try and make his way as an architect, and there gradually built up his reputation.
And that's just before and during World War II, and life for many Japanese Americans was really tough at the time. A real stain on American history is the internment of these American citizens in camps. Yamasaki was in New York, as you say, designing hastily built buildings needed for the war effort. What kind of discrimination did he face during the war?
Well, he faced a lot of examples of people who would come up to him on the street and accuse him of being a spy. Or they would say, one man once accosted him on the subway and said, what are you, Jap or Chinese, or, you know, grabbed him by the lapels. So he faced a lot of that kind of stuff, the kind of thing a lot of Japanese Americans were facing at that time. Later, when he moved to Detroit after World War II and tried to buy a home in some of the better suburbs like Bloomfield Hills, the realtors would not sell him a home, claiming that the realtors would say, well, we'll be driven out of the profession if we sell to you. He was designing a residential building in New York and was not allowed to have a unit in that building. The agent said, well, you know, your kids will fight with the other kids in the building. And he said, well, I don't have any children at this point. And that didn't make any difference. So he faced a lot of that kind of discrimination in his career. And yet he was so good at what he did and was so brilliant that he got these sort of high-end commissions, you know, from early on designing a naval base for the military at the height of World War II.
So after the war, as you mentioned, Yamasaki moved to Detroit. What kind of work was he doing at that point?
Well, he became the chief designer for the firm Smith Hinchman Grills, and they put him on a number of important projects, one of which the Federal Reserve building in downtown Detroit was the first modern, taller building in downtown Detroit at 160 West 4th Street, where I happen to work right now with the Detroit Free Press. The first glass, steel, and enamel building, first modernist design in downtown Detroit. And so he was building his reputation right away as a, as sort of the new modernist designer in downtown, in and around Detroit. He started his own firm after a few years. He was dissatisfied working in a major firm like Smith Hinchman, wanted to go off on his own and run his own firm, and did a lot of smaller projects initially, dental offices and some churches and schools and houses, did a whole lot of that stuff all over Metro Detroit, but wound up doing a couple of major projects in St. Louis.
Right. I want to ask you about those, but okay. Before we get to that, you know, I want to give people an idea about what his work looks like. You used the words serene, delightful. When did those sensibilities start appearing in his designs?
Well, from the earliest days, he was designing whatever the building was. He would design a sort of plaza. Often some little area that was recessed from the street that it would be landscaped to provide a little place where people could sit and just sort of get out of the hustle and bustle in life. So landscaping, connection to nature, little oases or enclaves where people could, they would not be in the building itself, but they would also not be on the street or on the sidewalk. There would be this little seating area that he would design. And from the very beginning, he's doing that. And then as he goes on in his career, those become much more elaborate.
You noted he was involved in work in St. Louis, Missouri, including the Lambert Airport Terminal, which is a point of pride in that city. He also designed the Pruitt-Igoe public housing project, and it's something he regretted later. Why?
Well, Pruitt-Igoe was one of the first of the major public housing projects, which basically in a lot of cities became filing cabinets for poor people. Where the authorities would try to stuff as many families in these places as possible. Yamasaki tried to argue for a smaller, less dense, lower rise type of design of this housing project. He wrote at the time that man is a ground animal. He needs to live near the trees and the grass in order to feel human. Again, going back to some of his early experiences, needing that connection to nature. But the St. Louis authorities insisted on packing as many people into these projects as possible. And so the buildings got taller and much more dense in terms of the number of people involved in them. And they were not successful by any stretch. They were not maintained very well. And within 20 years, the entire project was imploded. And Yama later said it was the worst mistake of his life being involved in this project.
In Michigan, Yamasaki is known for a number of buildings at Wayne State University. Those terms, serene and delightful, pop up again in describing those works. Tell me about a couple of those buildings.
Well, probably the most best-known one is the McGregor Memorial Conference Center on Wayne State University, and he designs this one. He's about 40 to 42 years of age, which is the age at which a lot of architects really start to come into their own, and he really, at this point, has evolved his design ethic. So the building itself only occupies about half the site, and the rest of the site is devoted to a very beautiful sculpture garden, reflecting pools, landscaping. The building is set up on a sort of pedestal for dramatic effect. It's fairly simple in form. It's got two wings divided by a central atrium that runs the length of the building with a skylight that runs the length of the building. But it's very serene, very precise, very elegant. So it combines what Yama saw in, say, for example, Japanese architecture, Japanese tea houses, which he had been to Japan shortly before this. So it kind of combines an elegance and a simplicity and a precision. And so really you have to accept the entire site as part of the architecture. It's not just the building, but it's the entire site. And it's designed to provide these oases of serenity and delight for the people who are going to use it.
Undoubtedly, the best-known design by Minoru Yamasaki is the World Trade Center in Manhattan. Because of the 9/11 attacks, those twin towers are a part of America's iconography. However, when the World Trade Center was built, it wasn't embraced by everyone. Why was that?
Well, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey let your ego get in the way here. They wanted the tallest buildings in the world, even though Yama told them when he got the commission that they'll only be the tallest buildings in the world for a short while until someone else does something taller, which was, in fact, what happened. And again, as a Pruitt-Igoe, he argued for a series of smaller, slimmer towers that would surround a central plaza. And the Port Authority insisted on not only the tallest buildings in the world, but that they had to have 10 million square feet of office space, which is a huge amount. And so these buildings got much taller and stouter, thicker than Yama had wanted. But he did his best. They were so big that they appeared to be out of proportion to the New York City skyline. And so they were really kind of blistered by critics, particularly the critic from the New York Times, Ada Louise Huxtable. And in the book, there's a description of how that relationship played out. So I think that they made Yama both a world-famous architect, but also drew a lot of criticism to him.
As you say, the World Trade Center really did make him a worldwide name. But you wrote his personal life was at times troubled. What kind of struggles did he face?
Well, he, besides this enormous pressure that he put on himself going back to his childhood to be successful, there was a drive for perfectionism in his life that never let up. And partly as a result of that, he suffered from illness a good deal in his life. He suffered from bleeding ulcers and other issues. He was hospitalized a number of times in his life, thought to be close to death. He also had a troubled marital life. He worked so hard that his relationship with his wife, Terry, began to fall apart. They were married for 25 years and then divorced. He had two sort of very quick failed marriages and then reunited with Terry and remarried and spent the rest of their lives together. So I think between the illnesses, between the overwork, between his troubled marital history, he had a very difficult time. But I think that that led to this search for serenity in his work, so that he poured all of that into creating these moments of tranquility and serenity for the people who would use his buildings.
Mr. Yamasaki died in 1986, age 73. What kind of legacy did he leave behind?
Well, he left behind a few hundred very wonderful buildings, all of which, or at least many of which, have these plazas and gardens and sculpture gardens in connection with nature. Buildings like Temple Beth El, for example, in Oakland County, which are there. And whenever you're in one of them, you begin to sense what he was trying to do, creating these oases of tranquility for the people who would use his building.
Did he have influence on other architects?
Yeah, I think beyond that, I think clearly the notion that any important public building now has to have either a plaza or some kind of connection to nature, something that takes the building beyond just the building itself, but become something larger, something that that takes into account how the people who are going to use it are actually feel. And I think you can trace a lot of that to Yamasaki's work.
We've been talking about the book, Yamasaki in Detroit, A Search for Serenity, A Look at the Life and Work of Minoru Yamasaki. It was written by John Gallagher, who many of you will know from his many years at the Detroit Free Press. John, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Coming up, a kid from Ann Arbor walks into a bar.
And then this person who I didn't know came up to me and said, "Hey man, that's John McSherry right there." So then I commenced to stare. And that's where John's story begins, was my staring.
Emily Fox takes us back to the early days of the Olam, an experimental Irish fusion band. And that's coming up in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Lester Graham. Michigan Congresswoman Candace Miller surprised many last May when she announced she'd be retiring from Congress. But she surprised even more folks in March when she announced she'd be running for Macomb County Drain Commissioner. Congresswoman Miller, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much. Delighted to join you.
So why is this such a head scratcher for so many?
Well, you know, Zoe, I hope that my approach to public service over the years has never been about blind ambition. Rather, it's about where I think I can make the most amount of impact in a positive way, whether that's in my community or my state or my country. And I have had the great, great fortune of being selected by my constituents to serve at all of those various levels of government. But, you know, a year ago I decided I did not want to seek re-election to Congress. I've loved this job. It's been a great honor. It's fantastic, but the truth is, I'm a Michigan girl, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Washington, D.C., and it was time for me to come home to Michigan, and really, this particular job has jurisdiction over, for instance, all of the pump stations in Macomb County, and in the last several years, there's been over 7 billion gallons of combined sewer overflows dumped into the Clinton River in Lake St. Clair, and, you know, a principal advocacy of mine has always been protecting our waters and our lakes. And I think with what is going on with the city of Flint, that underground infrastructure is going to be a huge issue. And this is an area that I am hopeful, if I'm successful, that I could have some real positive impact.
What is it about Washington in the past few election cycles? So many incumbent Congress people, women, congressmen, leaving, taking off, whether it's just to be done with jobs in the public service or coming back to states and doing different jobs. Is D.C. just so broken that folks are just saying, you know what, I'm done with it?
Well, I think everybody comes to their own conclusion of when and if they want to leave. I mean, quite frankly, you have many members, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, not a partisan thing, that stay here until they literally are taken out on a gurney. They're here for decades and decades. And God love them, but that was never my intent. I actually believe in the genius of the founding fathers who thought, particularly in the House, that you would be a citizen activist from some part of the country, and you would run, and if you won, you came to Washington for some period of time, and then you'd go home again. Mm-hmm. But I just want to come home to Michigan, and of course, I have been born and raised in Macomb County, Michigan, the home of the Reagan Democrats, by the way, which is really going to have a focus this election cycle. And again, I think that this particular office has huge potential for having the right kind of economic development in our county, for encouraging a blue economy when we have these fantastic natural resources that unfortunately have been fouled literally by so many sewer overflows. And you know what? We just don't have to live that way.
Indeed. This race was called one of the, quote, oddest, most intriguing 2016 races in Michigan. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. I mean, you have a person who's been a 24-year incumbent, and then you have me, who, you know, is an incumbent in another office. So I'm the challenger in this area. And I mean, the fellow that's been there has been there, as I say, over 2 decades. When I mentioned about how terrible I think this is with all these sewer overflows, his response was, "Well, that's been going on for years." Well, yes, that's That's right. That's actually why I'm running here, to make this change, because that is not the correct answer. And the status quo is not the correct approach, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so it will be up for me, of course, to try to see if I can get 51% of the voters in Macomb County to agree that it is time for a change in this office.
When will we see you start campaigning here in the state for the job?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to get my finances together, to tell you the truth. First of all, the incumbent is a multimillionaire, and so I'm anticipating that it's going to be a very expensive campaign, and I've got many, many people that are coming forward that want to support my candidacy. You know, there's already been, we're getting ready for the summer activities, whether that's parades or festivals or what have you, and we're at it. Of course, on the other hand, I'm still a member of Congress, so I'm still out in Washington here voting back and forth every week. So it's I've got a lot of things I'm juggling here, but I'm very enthusiastic about this challenge, and we'll see how it goes, but I hope to be successful.
Mm-hmm. One of the other, I think probably some would say, most intriguing 2016 races, obviously, is the weight race for the White House. Earlier this week, you announced that you are supporting Donald Trump. Talk to me a little bit about being a Republican right now in 2016. We've got Speaker Ryan and Trump meeting. So much attention on where the GOP is at today. Why this week did you come out for Trump?
Because he is the presumptive nominee. I totally anticipate him being the nominee for our party. And I, quite frankly, although I certainly don't agree with everything that Donald Trump has said, I feel very strongly that many of the issues that he is talking about will resonate, certainly in my county of Macomb County, when you talk about trade issues or you talk about currency manipulation, manufacturing, the economics of all of this, the auto industry. These are huge issues for a county like Macomb. And I think that Speaker Ryan will eventually come around here. He's just at this meeting, the speaker said that it was so critically important that Republicans unite around principles, that we share conservative agenda and do everything that we can to win this fall. And I have said the two words that really resonate when you think about this fall's election are the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, I believe. You might think about the upcoming 4 years, but in that context, you can think about the next 40 years. And whoever is the president is going to be able to appoint one, if not several, members of the Supreme Court. And I think you're going to see that being a really a marquee issue in the fall campaign.
So in that respect, you obviously then saying that you would trust a Trump decision on the Supreme Court rather than a Clinton or Sanders.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I look at Hillary Clinton, and I just don't want to see her as president. It's a binary decision here. I mean, at this point, although I have to say I've really appreciated the Bernie Sanders campaign. I think it's been very interesting watching him. I honestly think that many of the Bernie Sanders folks are either going to be turned off to Hillary or they may support Trump. I think you're going to have some of that. I tell you, if you were teaching political science this year, you would have plenty of material.
Too much material. You wouldn't be able to fit it all into one class.
No, It is really the most interesting dynamics, I think, that we've ever seen. If you think on the Republican side, where we had 17 people on the stage initially, and I will just note that every single one of them signed the pledge that they would support the nominee. By the way, that's not happening with some of them. I don't know what that means. I mean, if you sign a pledge and then all of a sudden you say, well, no, I guess I didn't really mean it.
One of the concerns, though, that is bandied about, at least within the Beltway and political, political watchers, is this idea that Donald Trump on the top of the ticket won't be good for Republicans down lower on the ballot, smaller races, including the race that you will be running for County Drain Commissioner. Do you have concerns about down ballot races and the Donald Trump effect?
I actually think if you think about a county like Macomb, and quite frankly, the state of Michigan, which normally you'd have to say the lean would be toward a Democratic nominee for president. In this case, with Donald Trump, I think Michigan is very much in play. I think the entire electoral map is going to be changing, as evidenced by the recent poll that showed that he was neck and neck in three critical states, a dead heat in Florida, Ohio, and, surprisingly enough, Pennsylvania. And if that is happening in Pennsylvania, I believe it's going to be happening in Michigan as well. And certainly in Macomb County, home of the Reagan Democrats, And in regard to my own personal race there for Public Works Commissioner, I will also note that the highest ranking Democrat in Macomb County is our county executive, Mark Hackle,
who has endorsed
you. He has endorsed my candidacy in a very vocal way and is helping me in every way that he possibly can, because he knows that there has to be a change in this particular office. I mean, other than that, he's endorsed all Democrats. But in this case, he has endorsed me very vocally and said, look, we need to have clean water. We also need to have clean government. And it is time for a change in that office.
Well, let's look forward quickly before we say goodbye. I would be remiss if I did not bring up the gubernatorial race in Michigan in 2018. Many folks saying that you coming back for the county commissioner job is sort of a stepping stone for a statewide run in 2018 as governor. You have not ruled that out, correct?
You know, I will tell you, Zoe, I am totally focused on 2016, and I am very focused on this Public Works Commissioner slot. And if the people of Macomb County are gracious enough to let me have a chance to have an impact here, I'm going to do my very darndest, roll up my sleeves, and do the best job that I possibly can for them.
Michigan Republican Congresswoman Candace Miller, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
As part of Michigan Radio's Songs from Studio East series, we're exploring music that combines both contemporary and traditional music from around the world. Today, we meet Tyler Duncan of Ann Arbor and John McSherry of Ireland. Despite being an ocean away, they play in a band together called the Olam. The Olam has toured across the U.S. and in Europe, playing a fusion of pop, rock, and Irish music. Emily Fox takes us back to the beginning days of the Olam, a friendship that started 17 years ago.
Tyler Duncan is a musician and producer in Ann Arbor. He's toured across the country playing in pop, rock, and electronic groups. But he's also won international competitions for playing traditional Irish instruments. He plays the Illion pipes, basically Ireland's lighter version of the Scottish bagpipes, and whistles, which are usually the first sound that comes to mind when you think of Irish music. Duncan's love for Irish music started nearly two decades ago.
My aunt gave me a VHS tape of a little show called Riverdance. Not so cool anymore. The cool points go down with that. But I liked the show. The show was cool, I remember as a kid. I mean, we're talking like an 11-year-old right now, but the thing that really grabbed me, though, was this solo that happens by a piper named Davy Spillane, who comes out and just performs this solo piece. And that, like, just, you know, as a kid, I just was like, whoa, what is that? What is that instrument? And that got me really interested in the pipes, and ended up kind of fighting through all the barriers of not being in Ireland and no one knowing about it and trying to figure it out. And one person kind of knows somebody who might know something. And
Duncan started learning how to play traditional Irish music in the States. But he says he really needed to spend time in Ireland in order to truly learn the instruments. Then when Duncan was 13, he was able to spend a year in Ireland because his father took a sabbatical there. At that point, Duncan had gotten his hands on other music that was coming out of Ireland, besides Riverdance.
I had this tape someone made me that had nothing on it other than the name, the word Lunasa, and I didn't know how to say it, and I'd listened to it. And then I remember I just couldn't help but listening to this tape that was handwritten on it and not knowing what it was, who it was, where it came from. And I kind of realized, like, man, whoever's playing the pipes on this is, like, the best I've ever heard. Like, this stuff is serious.
Duncan says this pipe player was one of the leading players in Ireland that was taking this music forward. Duncan kept listening to the tape, studying it.
And I started trying to figure out who it was. And this is before the internet really had that information on it, funny enough. So talking to people, I learned that it was a person named Ron McSherry.
Then when Duncan was in a town in Western Ireland, he had the chance to meet this musician.
And then I was in a session in Milltown, but it was kind of serendipitous that I was in this session, which is a jam session. We call it a jam session here. And this person next to me was like, hey, you know, you sound like you don't sound terrible on the pipes. You know, from America, huh? And And he asked me who my favorite piper was, and I said Ron McSherry. And he said, well, I think you mean John McSherry. And I was like, I don't know. I said, yeah, you just have a tape. And he said, well, that guy's at the bar, actually. And I went to the bar, and then there was a ton of people at the bar. The place was packed. This festival was really crazy. And I had no idea how to even start. I'm not going to ask every single person. And so I decided I was like about to give up. And then this person who I didn't know came up to me and said, hey, man, that's John McSherry right there. And like pointed him right out for me, who didn't know I was looking for John and didn't know me. So then I commenced to stare. And that's where John's story begins, was my staring.
Tyler, I think he was staring at me for a long time. And my girlfriend turned around and said, John, there's some kid here staring at you. And I think you should turn around and see what the crack is. So I turned around. And then Tyler introduced himself to me and said he had been a fan of a band that I'd played in. So that was the start of our friendship.
John McSherry was 29 and Duncan was 13 when they first met in Ireland. After they met, Duncan says they started playing together informally.
Just in these sessions that happen in Ireland all the time.
As Duncan mentioned before, sessions is the shorter term for what we call jamming or jam sessions in the States. But in Ireland, musicians are playing and improvising with Irish music and on traditional Irish instruments.
Huge part of the culture is this social component where people play acoustically in pubs, and it's just like kind of anybody can play, and it's a huge, huge thing there, and it's an incredible tradition. I miss it so much every time I'm not there, but that's how we started playing.
McSherry says Irish music is alive and well in that country, but it wasn't always. For centuries, England tried to take over the land in Ireland, and for a time the English would severely punish Irish people for speaking Gaelic, for Irish dancing, or playing Irish music.
I remember my daddy telling me that his mum, when she was going to school and if she was caught speaking Irish, what they used to do is they would tie something around somebody's neck and tighten it every time there was a word, you know, they heard a word of Irish coming out of their mouth, you know, the kid's mouth. So that was right up until the 20s and 30s, that kind of thing, for the language. And the music then, before that, people were being hung, would have been hung for playing the harp. I mean, there was a lot of people hanged for playing the harp. That goes back till about the 1600s, 1700s.
And why would they be punished for playing the music? Because they were kind of embracing their Irish heritage?
Yeah. Well, England tried to totally obliterate Irish culture.
And centuries later, McSherry and Duncan are keeping that Irish music alive in a new form, as Duncan explains.
I think in a lot of ways, the Ollam is a very liberated type of music. Like, we've been free to kind of make any sound we want, combine cultures and do it across an ocean and do it in a way without any sort of fear of backlash or controversy. And those safeties and those securities that allow us to be experimental weren't necessarily in place for the people we've been influenced by. So it's a very fortunate place to be.
As part of Michigan Radio's Songs from Studio East series, you can see Duncan playing this experimental Irish fusion music. We've posted a video on our website, michiganradio.org. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
Songs from Studio East is supported in part by the Michigan Humanities Council, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, Daniel Reisel, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in for Lester Graham. Thanks so much for listening.